This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hundreds of rats lived happily in a deserted house near a riverside. One day, a group of elephants came to the river to drink water. As they came running, they stamped many rats.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Buy the Book. I'm Lee Tree Lin, and with me, fellow animal lover, Shamila Ganesan. And today, we also have a special guest in the form of Wong Siew Lin, who is an editor at Makaranga. And we have Siew Lin here with us because we, today, for this episode, wanted to mark World Animal Day, which is celebrated on October 4th, also because it is the feast day of St. Francis Assisi. You know, it's just a lot of animal lovers and welfare kind of all packed into one day. And so we wanted to talk about the role of, I guess, the role that animals play in books and how we think and write and read about them. Siew Lin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
We've got a lot to talk about, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it sounded like a manageable topic when we first came up with it. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized how far just that broad theme of books about animals, however you choose to interpret it, how far they extend, because they really run the gamut from literally books that have animals in them as characters or, you know, or humans with their animals, all the way to where animals are anthropomorphized and they are literally the human stand-ins. And, you know, it's magical and it's real life. There are fables. There's a lot.
There's poetry as well, which we're not going to get into, but there's a lot of poetry to do with animals. Siew Lin, so when we extended the invitation, what, I guess, were your initial thoughts about the topic?
Well, yes, certainly. It was very interesting because it took me a while, actually, to sort of realize, very much like Shamila, that the breadth of you know, coverage by literature is simply ginormous. And I think the immediate thing that came to mind was actually Aesop's fables. You know, the use of animals in allegories, especially, I think, are the most widespread use and probably the most commonly known in by the public. You know, but obviously, from Life of Pi to, you know, huge sort of books, there's a lot of literature featuring animals.
And I think it extends from children to adulthood as well, from children's books to adult books as well.
Yes, that's right. It does. But I think, you know, especially for children, I think, how do you teach children lessons? You know, I think the use of animals in terms of, again, back to fables and as allegories, extremely popular in every language, in every culture. I think it really cuts across class, gender, culture, country, you know, the works.
And I think that's really an interesting point, because one of the things I started thinking about more and more is, why animals? Why do we use animals to tell these stories? Why can't the lion that was rescued in a forest by a mouse have just been two people? And I think there's something a little magical or unknowable about the animal world as well, where we can kind of ascribe characteristics to them in a way that maybe with humans feels a little more difficult to do. And animals are also great tropes. They kind of stand in for particular, like a lion is noble or arrogant, a fox is wily or cunning. And I think these are all very easy ways to talk to both children about certain values or morals, but actually even for adults to immediately code a particular way of thinking.
That goes all the way back to Aesop's fables as well, because if you think about where it is that we obtain those tropes, right? Why is it that we associate certain animals with certain behaviors? That also comes very, very directly from the fables and fairy tales that we grew up with. So we're going to be coming at you with different recommendations, I think, in this half hour. Sharmila, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I thought I would start actually with one of the oldest collection of animal-related stories or fables, which is the Panchatantra, which is from India. It's thought to be written, you know, as early as 300 AD, but has its roots even further back in oral folktales. And, you know, they're very similar. If you've read Aesop's fables, they'll be quite familiar to in structure, because they are usually about various animals that each represent, as I said earlier, particular characteristics. characteristics or values. They get into particular scenarios, and at the end, there's a sort of lesson to be taken away. And you know, the lessons range from things like friendship to warfare to how to survive. Sometimes it's not really the nicest person that wins. So some of them are quite practical life lessons as well. And yeah, I first got introduced to them in comic form with this series called Amar Chitra Katha, which is an Indian series of comic books. And I remember just being really charmed by them in the same way many of us probably remember liking Sankanchil or Aesop's Fables. And I still I still think very fondly of those stories.
And I think, Sulin, the stories that you wanted to talk about, and I use the word stories advisedly here because I think that it's not necessarily just books that we wanted to discuss, are kind of linked in some ways to what Sharmila was talking about.
Exactly. So I think the Panchatantra is the most widely translated book in the world to date, right? Yeah, so it's available in all different languages. And also, it's interesting that people have traced how these stories have crossed oceans and crossed geographic boundaries. And I haven't read enough, but presumably they actually influenced the telling of folktales in many, many different locations. So the link there really to indigenous folktales, which is what I thought, I'd share. And I draw upon this series of oral literature. It's called the Dayak Series Oral Literature. It's done by the wonderful people from the Institute of Borneo Studies at UNIMAS, University of Malaysia Sarawak, right? So what they did was to go around collecting, documenting some of these folk tales that have been told from father to son, mother to daughter, for many, many generations. And because of the change in cultural lifestyle, a lot of these risk being lost, yeah? So these are also oftentimes allegories. These are also fables. Yeah, they were used largely for entertainment. Yeah, but they are also important conduits of traditional culture, knowledge, and values. Yeah, and many of them, not all, but many of them feature animals. Yeah, and they also contain specific knowledge about animals and humans' relationship to animals, which is what I believe this day is about, right? This World Animal Day. Mm. And also how to live lives, you know, pantang larang. So what I find interesting also is how these indigenous tales, and I have three collections here, one on Penan, one on Bidayo, and one on Iban tales, right? And they feature not just charismatic animals, not just like your elephant and your tiger, but they also feature like tiny little things like snails, like butterflies, bamboo. You know, it's fascinating. And I think a lot of times we don't realize that these are actually part of life forms as well. And you can see that this whole approach, this indigenous approach to nature and lifestyle, everything is kind of like on the same level. And let's not forget spirits, the spirit world as well. Yeah. So just to give you an example, so the Penan Suket, they call them, these traditional tales are called Suket. Yeah? Almost every one of the seven stories in this collection that I have featuring animals, it ends with, "And that is why." So this is how knowledge is translated. And I think all of us are actually really familiar with that. So if I can just very quickly go through some of these. So one of the stories goes, "Even to this very day, the feathers around Kang Kaput's neck are sparse, for these are the feathers that fell out because of the loop Mother Monkey put around Kang Kaput's neck." You know, and then you have another one which ends, "And that is why, that is how the Penan know the coming of the fruit season. They watch the behavior of the Argus pheasant," you know. And just one last one, again, it ends, "So, you know, their wives were very angry because their husbands hadn't observed the important custom of sharing. They were mean and stingy to each other, behaviors despised by the Penan," you know. So there's always a "and that is why" kind of ending, which is lovely, allegorical, fable-like.
I love that connection between the locality of the space, because one of the challenges with something like the Panchatantra, which has been retold and reimagined and is now told in English, is that a lot of the specificities are lost. You know, I remember, for instance, when I was growing up, my grandmother told me a story. I don't even know if it's actually from the Panchatantra, if it's a folktale, but it was about a mustard seed that kind of gained gained sentience. And I know it's not about animals, but again, it's one of those things that are so weirdly peculiar to a particular culture in a particular space. And over time, I think when they get transferred down, a lot of these specificities get flattened.
I agree with that. But I also think that the oddness of it is in some cases the universality, because this is something that we also addressed early on, right? The idea of mythos and how you do see recurring themes coming up. Because when you were saying earlier, Sweetlin, and that is why, I was thinking about myths that range from African stories to Greek stories that do have this very same thing. And I love the idea that in order to impart some sort of knowledge, it was necessary or desirable to insert some poetry into it so that people would remember that this is when the fruits ripen, that you don't step there because snakes are there, for example. So I just really, I love that. And I want to read the collections. So just to say, Sharmila for the Panchatantra, is that widely available? Is that something people can get in any bookshop in any version?
I think you'll be able to find different collections of it in most places. And you can also find online, if you want to order the comic book that, which kids might really like, you can find them online as well. And that's the Amar Chitrakatha series.
And Sulin, same thing, because I think normally we start with like easy wins. Everybody can just pop out to their nearby bookshop and get them. So for your collections that you're talking about that collect oral stories, folk tales, where can people read them?
Yeah, unfortunately, they're not so easily available because these are actually monographs published by the University of Malaysia Sarawak. But you never know. Try writing to them and, tell them this is the copy of the book that you like. And there might actually be electronic versions available as well. I think these these came out a long time ago, 2001. But you never know, there might be still books in some library somewhere.
Or somebody reprint them. They sound great.
Exactly. I think nowadays, growing interest in Indigenous knowledge, all the sort of climate change and all the different environmental threats that we're facing, Indigenous knowledge is actually coming up and people are pushing it, and conservationists are pushing Indigenous knowledge up in terms of ways, knowledge. How do you counter the California fires? The Indigenous people actually used to burn forests selectively, and that was one way that the fires did not grow so big. Obviously, now we have climate change, so on and so forth, but let me not go there.
Okay, so today we are talking about animals in stories, in fiction, in writing, and that is in conjunction with World Animal Day, which is celebrated annually on October 4th. We are going to be continuing this conversation, but if you'd like to share your favorite pieces of writing that involve animals or animal welfare or conservation, these themes, you can let us know what they are. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, and of course, you can write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila and our guest today, Wong Siew Lin from Makaranga. And together we are observing and celebrating World Animal Day, which falls on October 4th. So we started off the show by talking about I guess in some ways, stories that are very old, that are passed from generation to generation. And I wanted to extend that a little bit by talking about a children's book. And that is Charlotte's Web, which is, of course, written by E.B. White.
"Where's Papa going with that axe?" said Fern to her mother as they were setting the table for breakfast. "Out to the hog house," replied Mrs. Arable. "Some pigs were born last night." "I don't see why he needs an axe," continued Fern, who was only 8. "Well," said her mother, "one of the pigs is a runt. It's very small and weak, and it will never amount to anything. So your father has decided to do away with it." "Do away with it?" shrieked Fern. "You mean kill it? Just because it's smaller than the others?" Mrs. Arable put a pitcher of cream on the table. "Don't yell, Fern," she said. "Your father is right. The pig would probably die anyway." Fern pushed a chair out of the way and ran outdoors. The grass was wet, and the earth smelled of springtime. Fern's sneakers were sopping by the time she caught up with her father.
"Please don't kill it," she sobbed. "It's unfair."
Mr. Arable stopped walking. "Fern,"
he said. It is one of the stories I read, I think, when I was a little bit a little bit younger, of course, which is an appropriate time to read it. It is a children's book, and it essentially tells the story of the relationship between between a livestock pig, Wilbur, and a barn spider named Charlotte, and they become unlikely friends. They talk about everything. Charlotte supports Wilbur through his life, you know, when he wonders about things, she imparts knowledge. And in many ways, I don't know if it's a spoiler to say, she saves him from what the inevitable fate of an animal on a farm is. And so I just wanted to bring it up because unlike the books that we spoke about earlier and the books that I think we're about to talk about, this is a book that does humanize. Thank you. This is a book that humanizes animals, makes no bones about it. You know, it's not really pretending to be anything else, but it is a great way to, I think about the animals that in many ways are closest to us, right? They're not far away. They're not mythical or mystical. They are the kinds of animals that you see in farms, in your homes, and sadly on your plate. So I think it helps to draw that connection, and it does it really well, especially for younger readers.
And Charlotte's Web does that thing where they still are animals. They're not sort of human characters. So they live in an animal's world. And I think that's, as a child, quite special because you kind of think of these books as an entry point into a world that you don't quite know or it seems familiar, but you want to know more about. And I think that's why, and Suelin mentioned the connection between humans and animals. I think that's why books like these are so uniquely positioned to create a sort of empathy because they are not your stand-ins, but instead you start seeing them as other living beings who have a life and have ways of being that might not be like yours. And I think that's something that's very important for a child.
I think so, definitely. I think this day and age, urbanization and the perpetual complaint about kids being forever connected to a screen, umbilically connected to a screen, it makes it actually quite dangerous and certainly for conservation, right? And people's awareness of the environment because you get further and further and further away from nature, including animals. So books like these play a very important role.
These books reminded me of a lot of Enid Blyton's books as well, which were always about animals and kids living very close to animals, which is something that we don't get a lot of anymore.
Yes, that's true. And I think that's partly because our idyllic visions of farms have been disrupted by what we now know them to be. You don't expect children to be living in these spaces anymore, but such is life. I think, Suelin, what is your next book?
Yes, it's a big one, Moby Dick.
Wow.
In many ways, the big animal novel.
Yeah. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long, I thought that I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Whenever I grow grim about the mouth and hazy in the eyes, whenever it's a damp November in my soul, I count it time to get to sea. Almost all men, sometime or other, cherish these same feelings toward the ocean.
So the book really is about a man, Ahab, in search of a whale, an elusive whale, Moby Dick, right? This was a book that I had to study at university, I have to say, decades ago, and I have to say that I didn't enjoy it then. It was extremely dense. I felt it was all over the place, and I definitely chose not to write about it. But I went back to it about, let's say, 6 to 7 years ago and read it cover to cover. And with a new consciousness of being an environmental writer, I found it absolutely fascinating. Because in this day and age where whaling is considered a no-no, a huge no-no, it is probably impossible to write a book like this, which has so many descriptions of what the whaling process is like. Now, people from PETA and all the animal rights groups will probably hate this segment of what I'm going to say, but I actually found it really fascinating. It is a kind of, whaling has changed, of course, you know, with a lot of fancy equipment and all the rest of it. So to read what a physical, dangerous, and almost exciting the way it was written task it is I actually really got drawn in it, although I do not condone the killing of whales. But that was something that somehow I missed all those years ago and during my first reading. And I want to mention that because there's a little bit of discussion about whether Melville actually was scientific in the way he wrote the book. Yes, it's fiction. But it does draw a lot from real life. It draws, it's based on the whaling industry, which is based in Nantucket, at the peak of whaling, right, in the entire world. And so I wanted to look at the science, or I'd like today to look at the science of the non-science of it. So the whole whaling part actually took up 10 or more chapters out of the 132 chapters, which is a lot. You know, it's really great descriptions of like the hunt, boats capsizing, people getting entangled in the harpoon ropes. And okay, spoiler alert, if nobody has read it, basically this is what happens to the main character. But really began around the time that Moby Dick, it began a long time ago, but reached its height during the time that Melville wrote Moby Dick, right? And Nantucket was the center of whaling in the US. So it did cost. So I'm going to touch a little bit on the conservation section of this. You know, really there was so much whaling going on at that time that it caused a massive demise of whales, right? So the bowhead, the right whales, and all that, all those have started going extinct until almost very recently, right? 1966. The bowhead was almost extinct until 1966. It's now still endangered. Yeah. So these are the whales that he features, and of course, Moby Dick itself is, or himself or herself, is a sperm whale. Yeah. And until today, it is actually vulnerable. So in the 1930s, countries started taking note, and the International Whaling Commission was set up to ban commercial whaling. So there's that whole, you know, thing going on, which makes, I think, Moby Dick a very interesting book to look at what it meant at that time, what it meant in terms of lifestyle, in terms of careers, and of course this whole symbolism of what does the whale mean, you know. I think for whale, for that whole symbolism, it is a book that really is very divisive. Like the whale can stand for so many different things, and in fact, even opposite things. Is it biblical? Is it about agnosticism? You know, is it about a single-minded, myopic drive? You know, or is it meandering, unfocused, all-embracing? You know, and I've found really interesting. Melville, just to, I don't know, throw things to make things a little bit more complicated or to make it easier. He has at the beginning of the book a whole section on extracts, which is basically, so he was doing his research. It's a list of any reference that he found that he could find containing whales. And it is a fascinating, fascinating read.
I love that. Also because, like you said, I think for the longest time, Moby Dick himself is seen really as a symbol, and what you're talking about turns him into a whale. It's a strange thing to say, but for a novel that is about a whale and about hunting a whale, the whale is never really thought of in that light. It's not very corporeal or physical, you know, it's very much a symbol and idea. And I just love the idea of setting it actually back in its space and saying, well, yes, but let's think about it as an animal.
Mm, I think it's quite telling that I never even thought of Moby Dick when thinking about animal books.
I think sea creatures tend to be like, you know, non-animal like kind of thing, you know.
They don't have feet.
Because they don't have feet, that, you know, they don't walk on land. Yeah, the sea is like this completely different realm altogether. Yeah, but this is another section also talking about this. The other big thing about his description of whales, it's not very scientific at all. You know, so he describes the whale as a spouting fish with a horizontal tail. That's Melville's description of a whale, right? But then he goes in and then he starts to classify them. And again, I'm not quite sure where he got this from, but he classified them according to size. But again, because it was based on what knowledge there was there, so it was heavily skewed towards oil-producing whales, right? And then he called Moby Dick the largest creature on Earth, and it's not. Even then, you know, the blue whale is the largest creature on Earth.
Yeah.
even then, blue whales did exist, you know. So why did he do that? So was he, as an author also, a writer of fiction, also fictionalizing the signs of this? It's just really interesting. Can you fictionalize signs? Can you make signs up?
Well, so that actually is related to, in some ways, a book that I wanted to talk about, which is Jack London, Jack London's White Fang.
It was the wild, the savage, frozen-hearted Northland wild. But there was life, abroad in the land, and defiant. Down the frozen waterway toiled a string of wolfish dogs. Their bristly fur was rimed with frost. Their breath froze in the air as it left their mouths, spouting forth in spumes of vapor that settled upon the hair of their bodies and formed into crystals of frost. Leather harness was on the dogs, and leather traces attached them to a sled which dragged behind.
I read it in a sitting simply because I was so gripped by the story. It's a very, very... it's a very strong narrative. It's very simple. It just essentially tells the life of a wolf dog before it had become fully domesticated, or before wolves had kind of really completed that transition into the pups that we see scampering around our houses today. And I think that White Fang, later on, so in reading about this, Jack London was actually kind of lumped in as a nature faker, right? As somebody who had imposed too much sentiment onto natural writing and not enough science. And that kind of runs contrary to what it is that I love about White Fang, which tells the story from the point of view of White Fang himself, of the wolf dog, and of the struggles that he faces trying to integrate into a pack, of what he feels when he is put into a situation where he's a dog in a dogfight, of what it means to him to be in those sort of visceral life or death situations. And that's where the emotion comes from. But the emotion's not from the dog. The emotion is from you as a reader thinking, oh my God, are you going to die right now? But what I love about White Fang is exactly that it is written from the perspective of an animal, and therefore it's not without that kind of reasoning and thought. It's based on instinct. It's based on, I guess, that idea of this is what I'm doing. I'm doing it because I'm doing it, not because I thought I was going to do it, not because I planned to do it. And so to that point about science, sentiment, making stuff up, I think Jack London and White Fang, as well as Call of the Wild, are an interesting entry in this space.
And I know we're sort of running out of time, but on that note of being told things from the point of view of an animal, Black Beauty was probably one of my earliest, Black Beauty by Anna Sewell was one of my earliest books that I remember sort of getting so attached to the animal that I was reading about, because it does that, but in a different way, because Call of the Wild and White Fang, they have a narrator. Whereas Black Beauty narrates the story. So you get the story from the horse's point of view, but it's still very much a horse. And so you're kind of not really sure whether it's an internal narration versus a... But yeah, just a great book in terms of capturing what it's like, the cruelty that humans are capable of inflicting on animals, but also the gentleness when you know, the right people come along. And I think just a great idea of our responsibility when we choose to, I suppose, in whatever way, make use of animals, what our responsibilities are in terms of humane treatment.
So for me, there is something to be said about, in many ways, all three of the books that we've been talking about in the second half, which allows the animals to simply be, whether or not scientifically accurately be, they are being. And for me personally, that's the aspect of animal stories that I relate to the most. The idea that you have a nature and ultimately it is about being true to your nature. How it is that you want to interpret that, is up to you. But I love the idea that animals are true to themselves because there is no other way to be. You know, they don't spend their time wondering. I think it was Stephen Fry who said, a bear doesn't go to sleep at night wondering if it was a good bear. It simply is. And that, I find, is what's most appealing about animal writing or animal characters in whether fiction or nonfiction.
And I think in this day and age, that's a great lesson for any of us to take away. I mean, we keep getting told that the best the best kind of wildlife is the wildlife you never see, or the best life for wildlife is when you don't see them. And I really think that as we encroach more and more onto their spaces, that it's worth thinking about their space and their natures.
Sulin, you mentioned earlier that you reread Moby Dick after deciding that you wanted to be a wildlife or an environmental writer, somebody who writes about this very space. And I just wanted to know, I guess, in closing, do you think it's important that people read about nature? That people read about nature, animals, wildlife. And is it important that they read about it in fictional settings as well as non-fictional settings? Because I think non-fiction and more informational articles are one thing, but what we've talked about today broadly has been fiction.
That's a very interesting question. Well, in the first place, just read, read anything and read as much as you can. I think that habit should be encouraged. Certainly, yes, I think books like Black Beauty and White Fang, I guess, if they help us, and what we've been talking about today, if they help us think more about what we are like as humans, how much of the beast is actually within us, and how much of a beast is in a so-called beast. If it helps us think about our relationship to the wild, whether it's an animal or a plant or a forest, and certainly if it helps us think about our relationship with each other, then I think, at the end, it will just help us think about ourselves as human beings. What sort of people do we want to be? What sort of individual do we want to be? How do we want to relate to each other, to animals, to the wider world? Is that very highfalutin?
No, I think it's perfect.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think highfalutin or not, that's the point of our show today in many ways, where we've been gathering to talk about writing and works to do with animals in conjunction with World Animal Day, which falls on October 4th. Sulin, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you very much. I had a lot of fun.
You heard that from Wong Siu Lin, editor at Makaranga. If you would like to share your thoughts on animals in books, in writing, again, in conjunction with World Animal Day, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. And you can also tweet us at BFM Radio or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. That brings us to footnotes, and we don't have a lot of time today because we wanted to give a little more love to animals in writing. It is, after all, our little World Animal Day episode, but we have a piece of news that we wanted to discuss, and it concerns some big players. So essentially, the Booker Prize... Okay, I'm going to leave it to you to set it up. I'm just going to give you these words. Booker Prize, Obama.
Whoever would have thought? Barack Obama is kicking out Booker Prize from its original awarding date. I think that about covers. Well, not him deliberately, like I made the decision, but basically the powers that be decided that because November is generally a very crowded landscape for, Western literature, a lot of awards are handed out. And then Barack Obama's memoir is going to be released as well on November 17th. So the Booker Prize, which is supposed to be awarded then, is now being moved to November 19th. That's pretty big news, actually.
It is, also because it puts it... basically, you mentioned earlier that it is a crowded literary landscape. And now with the Booker moving, it puts it in, I wouldn't say conflict, but it puts it rather too close to the National Book Awards, in America again. So all of which to say that, and this is something that we've spoken about on the show before, the Booker Prize used to primarily focus on non-American writers, non-American mm-hmm. books. And for that reason, I think you got exposure to a little more of the rich world of literature outside of the American publishing industry. And what this is, essentially, is an American heavyweight in all the ways that matter. The book is expected to sell like crazy. Of course, Barack Obama continues to be a huge name. So basically, an American heavyweight is kicking out the Booker from its original slot in a time where they are already being thought of as being overly Americanized and seeming to prove the point in the fact that they moved the date.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the National Book Awards, because previously when they did not, when the Booker was not open to the National Book Awards, which is an American award, they didn't have to worry that they were competing in the same space or necessarily overlapping authors. But ever since the Booker has become open to anyone, you know, the first year or two, it wasn't really overwhelmed by American writers, but we're certainly seeing more that happen more and more. You know, this year, out of the 6 shortlists, 3 are by American writers, and a 4th author is actually both Scottish and American. So that's actually quite a sweep. I mean, that's 4 nominees out of 6 for an award that's supposed to be open to, well, any English writer in the world. And so I think it is indicative, I think, of a direction that maybe people won't be entirely happy with.
Yeah, that, and also I am thinking about whether or not this gives a boost to book sales, because that's one of the main things. Look, of course, winning the Booker Prize, winning the National Book Award is huge. It is a tremendous recognition, and I'm not trying to take that away. It is, however, also a boost for sales. The fact that you get to put that little gold sticker on the front of your book that says that this was a winner, or for that matter, long-listed, shortlisted. And so I think that there has been some conversation and some concern that with the prizes coming back-to-back the way that they are, you aren't going to get that same name recognition as you would ordinarily get from winning the Booker Prize or from winning the National Book Award. And I guess, not to disparage what I'm sure is a good book, you know, the Obama's books, both President Barack Obama as well as former First Lady Michelle Obama, their books have been tremendously popular. So it feels as if writers who already might not be on the bestsellers list are being further pushed aside to make way for a book that, by all accounts, is going to be, you know, a big, big financial smash. So I think I understand what's happening. I don't love it. And the logic of it doesn't really kind of work out.
No, and it also does kind of show, I mean, I think I can guess why A Promised Land, which is Obama's memoir, is being released in November, because presidential election, perfect time to look back at the way things used to be. So I think what makes me uncomfortable is how much a space that is already small. I mean, you know, we talk about falling book sales every year. And in a space that's already difficult and small, how little regard some of these big American publishers seem to have for the rest of the literary world. Yes, it makes sense for Obama's book to come out at that time, but does it make sense to schedule it for exactly the date that the Bookers were going to be held? Should they not have had a conversation? Should they not have planned a way that celebrates literature as a whole? I think I'm just being too idealistic.
No, I get where you're coming from, but I think this is one of those victors live to tell the tale kind of thing.
Dollar, you know? The dollar will tell you what, you know, what works in the end, I suppose. I'm sorry, that went dark.
So with that said, President Barack Obama's memoir is coming out, you guys.
Despite our doubt, our you know, relative cynicism, I do think it'll be an interesting read.
Yes, I agree. But that's not what we were talking about. Basically, we've just spent our footnotes, you know, really in some ways discussing American dominance when it comes to publishing and in the landscape of book awards, as well as book selling in general, in light of the fact that the Booker Awards actually moved the date that they were going to announce the winners to make way or to not clash with the big book event that is President Obama's memoir being released.
Yeah, and then just those dates very quickly, the Barack Obama memoir is coming out on November 17th. The National Book Awards is on November 18th, an online ceremony. And the Booker Prize, also an online ceremony, is going to be awarded on the 19th of November.
Let us know if you have any thoughts on this. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and of course, write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.